right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Tide Chasers Podcast. Very excited for our guest today. Got some great content coming your way. Got my partner across the way, Qua. How you doing today, buddy?
Good as always, man. Ain't complaining.
Perfect. Today, we're going to welcome a fisheries biologist, a local fisheries biologist from the Philadelphia area. Her name is Kate McStravog at Pepperseed88 on Instagram. Before we get into chatting with her, just to give you some info how you can find us, Tide Chasers Podcast on Facebook, at Tide_Chasers on Instagram. We have all the links to all of our podcast shows in the bio on the Instagram page, as well as on the Facebook page. But without further ado, welcome, Kate. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks. Thank you guys for having me.
No problem. We're thrilled to have you on the show, and we're going to dive right in. So I've fished with you and Mike, you and your boyfriend Mike, in the past. We've tried to tangle with some walleye, but where did your early influences come from when you got into the fishing world? Like, as far as the actual fishing side of things, what was it that made you fall in love with fishing? And then we'll talk about how you got into doing that as a occupation a little bit later.
Of course. Well, thankfully, my dad was an avid hunter when I was a kid. I was never allowed to go hunting with him because my mom didn't think it was a very girly thing to do. But he did take us for sunnies and bass. So that's probably my childhood introduction. But my passion for fishing didn't really take off until I actually studied abroad in the Caribbean. I did a lot of marine conservation work down there. I worked with a lot of fishermen. I actually got invited to come back and work on a fishing boat. So I did a lot of commercial fishing down there, and my good friend, his name is Spice. he taught me the ropes of fishing, and it's just so weird being 21 years old. And my first experience fishing was hand lining and setting pots in the ocean and free diving for lobster and conch. So it was a pleasure being down there. I just got to go out every day with these fishermen and work hard, and It was a great time. I think it was probably one of the best experiences I ever had in my life. And no rods or reels, but it just kind of threw me into this passion for fish in general and fishing, and a lot of respect for these men that go out every day in the hot sun in the Caribbean, and they grind. And I, from start to finish, I would fish with them 8 to 10 hours a day. And then on the weekends, we would go sell them on another island and by truck sometimes even. So it's just an overall really cool experience that kind of like started everything with like my love for fishing, my love for the islands, my love for marine biology. And more recently, I never really fished when I came home though. I only like went down there. I never really did freshwater fishing or anything. Every time I fished, it was just in the Caribbean. But when I came home, I guess it kind of dropped off for a while because I didn't have anybody to go with. I'm a girl. None of my girlfriends went fishing until I met Mike. And I think that's really what sparked everything more recently. Like all my freshwater fishing started pretty much 8 years ago when I met him. And the funniest thing is all we would go for is flatheads and carp. And to sit on the banks of the Schuylkill River all night long, chunking corn and worms and sunnies. And I think pretty much the night he always tells me this, the night he actually fell in love with me was the night I actually gutted and dissected a flathead catfish to see what it was eating so he could determine what kind of baits we should be using.
True love there, folks. That's true love.
That's how you know she's a keeper, you know, the fact that she can dissect the flyhead and let you know what he was feeding on so I can go get the same bait and catch one too.
Can't be shy when you're a fishery scientist or a fisherman. Like, you got to gut your fish.
So. Now, Kate, you mentioned hunting. We have a previous guest that is looking for a female hunting partner. Her name is Nicole. We'll have to link you up. She's a little further north of us, but she... Hey, we were trying to put out a classified ads to find her a hunting girlfriend. So,
I shot guns my whole life, and my dad taught me all about gun safety and everything, but it just never took off because my dad always wanted to take me, and my mom's like, no, that I'm drawing the line at the animals thing. She's like, she can go fish and whatever, but
Now, when you were in the Caribbean, obviously you got ruined for every other kind of fishing you would do around here. But when you were in the Caribbean, was that where you decided that, hey, I want to do this fisheries biology thing? Or was it before that?
I always, like, my entire life growing up, I always wanted to be something with marine biology. Like, I wanted to be a dolphin trainer when I was a kid. And then in college, I was like, I'm still really interested in the ocean. I think it's really, like, it's like an alien planet. Like, it's the unknown. So I've always been drawn to the ocean. Another thing I forgot to mention, I grew up, all my summers were spent in Sea Isle City on my uncle's boat, and he would take us fishing too. So I think that just from those early experiences, I just kind of developed a passion for it. And then once I was in the Caribbean, I got to live that life. I did not want to, I cried every time I came home. I did not want to leave. Like, it was just, it's like living in paradise. I had minimal TV. It was like a giant camping trip. I had no electricity for 3 weeks. I had no running water. I used to have to bathe out of a bucket. Not many girls can handle that. But just waking up every morning to this beautiful landscape and being out on the water, and you're seeing all kinds of cool fish, dolphins, whales, seabirds, and just being around these lovely people in the Caribbean too. Like, everyone I knew down there was just so friendly and so happy, even though a lot of them didn't have much.
Gotcha. Now, where did you get your fisheries biology degree? Where did you study at?
So my track was a little curvy. I originally went to school I got my bachelor's in biology from Villanova University. Wasn't really sure where I wanted to go. So I just applied to a bunch of different schools. I was a little nervous to move really far away from home right off the bat, but Villanova gave me a grant. So, and it's a very prestigious school. So my parents are like, you'd be an idiot if you didn't go there. You need to go to Villanova. I had a really good education there. But the biggest thing is I got my bachelor's there, but they sent me abroad to Turks and Caicos, and that's where that experience happened.
Holy cow.
Yeah, they're like, oh, we don't have marine biology here, but do you want to go to the islands? And I was like, yes, please. That'd be great.
So I would say that based off of this conversation, you would recommend the program that they have in place there.
Oh, yes. It was awesome. That program was called, they're still around, it's the School for Field Studies. Mm-hmm. I was actually torn between going to Costa Rica or Turks and Caicos, but I was a little wary because I knew somebody who went to Costa Rica and he's like, oh, you're going to have to buy snake boots. There's so many venomous snakes there. And I was like, ooh.
Turks and Caicos it is.
Yep.
Exactly. And they said in Costa Rica that I'd be in a classroom a lot. And they're like, in Turks and Caicos, you're going to be working on a boat every single day. And I'm like, that sounds way more fun. We'll do that one.
For sure. Now, how long have you been studying varying fisheries, and what has been your biggest accomplishment in the field so far?
This will be my fifth year doing fisheries work. I started out as a fisheries technician, and now I'm technically a fisheries biologist. It's hard to say what like my biggest accomplishment would be because I am a scientist. I'm not published, but I would say that, let me think. We can pause here, right? I wrote some notes down. Let's see. So I guess my biggest accomplishment would just be to have the honor of learning so much information. I've spent a lot of time, I've done so many different projects. I have this whole plethora of knowledge, just being able to experience and see all these different water bodies throughout the tri-state area and being able to travel for work too. And I got to experience Texas for the first time in my life the past 2 years. I think just the biggest accomplishment in fisheries, it has brought me to so many wonderful people, like very well-educated people and a variety of people that have taught me so much when it's come to both science and fishing, because they kind of go hand in hand when you do fishery science. Like, I feel like a lot of my counterparts have a passion for fishing too. Like, I think that sparks why people go into that field of science as well.
What would you say your scientific knowledge of the fish helps you target different species of fish differently than you would had you not had that knowledge?
It's hard to say when you're used to it. For the most part, when I've just done a lot. All of our studies, typically you're looking into habitat, you're looking into fish health, you're looking into the ecosystem as a whole. You're not really studying, unless you're doing a specific study on feeding patterns. I've never really gotten to study their feeding habits or their aggression. It's more just we like to track fish. Like we, when I worked for the state of Delaware, we used to tag and track spawning striped bass or tag and track sturgeon to try to understand where they go, how they move around, and just like the seasonality of everything with them. The biggest advantage I would say would be spots. Maybe not so much the a lot of the places that I've worked at mostly for the state, honestly, would be recreational areas. They want people to fish. They want people to catch good fish, and they want trophy fisheries. Like the biggest example is I did a little bit of work with the lake trout in Round Valley Reservoir. And I know the trophy fishing has kind of dropped off a little bit. My boss is amazing. Like he's just like, we need to make sure these fish are healthy. We need to figure everything out we can. They want people to catch fish, and they want to make these good fisheries. Like, you know, you want your kids to catch them. You want people to have these activities. Hold on, let me try to think. Well, I lost my train of thought. Too much of my
mind. It happens.
I do it often, and I do this every week. So.
Oh yeah, and the scientists were scatterbrained. So.
Now, you, myself, and Mike have talked briefly when we've been out walleye fishing about some of the crazy things you guys see out there in the field, like fish that should not be in certain areas or in certain areas. Like, what would you name a couple things that you think you've seen that just blows your mind, I guess is the best way to put it.
Let me pull up my list. I went through my photos today. So it's just, I think it's just really neat when, okay, so let me just start with this. So for my latest project working on the Delaware River in a more industrial setting, we did 12-hour shifts. You're either the 12-hour day shift or the 12-hour night shift. And it's crazy to see there's a huge difference between day shift and night shift. When you're day shift, you know, you're relaxing, you know, you can have an early day on Friday. Like there's not going to be that many fish. Night shift's a totally different story. And we typically get these oddities. We'll get some during the day, but it usually happens at night. I think the craziest thing, like growing up around here and fishing the Delaware River watershed, is I never thought I would see so many saltwater fish. We would get a handful. It wouldn't be like all the time, but we would see things like juvenile sheep's head, juvenile jack crevel all the way up the river, as well as adult and juvenile summer flounder. The weirdest thing I got, I actually had to look it up because I didn't even know what it was. It was a drum, but it wasn't a black drum. I've seen plenty of juvenile black drum and almost larval black drum too. It was a banded drum. I didn't even know they existed around here. And it's cool to see these creatures in science because these are things you can't catch rod and reel. And the other thing we got recently towards the end of my project that I always wanted to see and I never got a chance to was a four-spine stickleback.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to Google that.
Yeah, Google. Siri, can you tell me what
four-spine stickleback?
They're a weird looking fish. It almost looks like a bass and a seahorse had a mini baby. I don't even know. Like they're just, it's so cool to see these tiny little fish, and they don't get much bigger than maybe a couple inches that you would never be able to see out fishing. Like, I think that's definitely a benefit of my job is seeing all the creatures that live in these water bodies. And the saltwater fish were a surprise enough. And even seeing freshwater fish I've never heard of was really interesting. Cause even working electrofishing, gill netting, you see all the common minnows, daces. Every now and then you'll get like, we catch snakeheads occasionally gill netting too, or hull seining. But I think the saltwater really was what shocked me. I think out of all of them though, the biggest shock was definitely getting a juvenile Atlantic cutlass fish, which it's like a unicorn. I feel like I only see or hear them getting caught or seen out in the ocean.
That's pretty crazy. Now, couple of years back, we were seeing like on the Schuylkill, some of these freshwater drum popping up. Have you seen any of those in the area in any of your studies?
I've heard about it. I've never seen them, electrofishing or gill netting. But I guess anything's possible. I was talking to a guy the other day. In the Norristown area, and he was telling me this crazy story. He's like, I caught this fish. It was silver and it had fangs. I'm like, it had fangs? And he's like, yeah, it was this big silver fish with fangs. And I'm like, the only thing I know that has fangs is a weak fish. But it wouldn't be shocking for something like a weak fish or a drum, if it could find its way into the Delaware River, to just follow the current and go through, if those fish ladders are clear, to just make their way up.
Gotcha. Now, we talked about you've gone to Texas for your job. Now, how often does your job take you to, you know, different areas, like different states, like south, north, whatever it may be? How often does your job take you out to different locations and different fisheries that you're not used to from this area?
Well, that's a pretty new experience for me. When I worked for the state of Delaware and New Jersey, I got to travel every single day. There's only a handful of fisheries technicians, fisheries biologists. So I got to see like a whole variety of water bodies. I got to see almost every single lake, stream, river. That was cool. But this job, I work for a consulting firm, and we do respond to oil spills and fires. So we had it's Texas. There's a lot of industry down there. Let's say.
Yeah, for sure.
Bad fire, and even, you know, the firefighting foam they use to put out the fire. There's, you know, any time you introduce a chemical to a water body, there's going to be a response. So it was cool that, like, it was probably my first month at work, and I've never done private work. I've never been in a consulting business at all. They just hired me as their fisheries biologist for the industrial work on the river I do. And they're like, oh, pack your bags, you're going to Texas immediately. And I was like, I'm like,
okay.
Trained. And I was like, well, what do you guys want me to do there? And they're like, just here's your plane ticket, just show up and we'll go from there. So it happens suddenly. If they win a job, they just send us, especially for an emergency like that. And it's pretty intense because you have control centers. So I'm dealing with the Coast Guard, Fish and Wildlife, our firm, other firms. And it feels like a whirlwind. Like, you just show up at this control center, they're trying to get you a badge, and I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing down here. Yeah. And then they briefed me and they're like, oh, we need to collect fish tissue samples. I was like, I'm all for that. All right. And it's funny when you're the only fisheries biologist in your office, and that's why they send you there. And they're like, well, what do you need to collect these fish? And I'm like, I don't know. What do you want me? Like, you guys, I don't know what to do. So they're like, what's the best way to efficiently collect fish? I'm like, gill net, hook and line. I don't know. So at first, like, this is pretty funny, I can talk about this. So I talked to my one boss and I was like, well, I need a gill net. And he's like, all right, well, I'll send you a gill net. And it was a 30-foot gill net. I was like, bro, this isn't going to catch anything. This is way too small. So just from meeting so many people, being so new, all these introductions, I got to meet some of the captains of our boats. And the one guy, born and raised, his name is Albert. He's now a good friend of mine. He was one of my captains. So I was talking to him about collecting fish. And he was a commercial fisherman growing up, pretty much, I think. Like, he's like, oh my God. He's like, you need gill nets? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, he's like, I have like hundreds and hundreds of feet of gill nets I would love to dust off. So he's like, I'd love to help you out, collect these fish so we can send them to the lab. I'm like, perfect. So that was a pretty cool experience, just getting to meet all these Texans and Louisiana people and going out gill netting every day. And that did some damage, having a 300-foot gill net compared to a 30-foot gill net. We were able to get the specimens we needed because they wanted a variety. They wanted bait fish. They wanted red drum, black drum, sea trout, flat, like any like major recreational fish. Cause I think we worked closely with Fish and Wildlife because it would affect consumer advisories. It would affect shutdowns for both commercial and recreational fishing. And we were testing for, and this is a new, I'm sure you guys have heard in the news, like PFOS and PFAS. Have you heard about those chemicals before?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Yes. So it's pretty much from firefighting foam. They've even been doing studies in the Delaware River watershed too. And it can be a little scary because with consumer advisories, they never tested for these. It might change a lot of the consumption of the fish in both Texas and our area, especially in high industrial places.
Now, that was another question I was going to ask you a little down the road, but the work you're doing, does it ultimately have an effect on how regulations are come about? Like, do you have any kind of, maybe not direct say, but do you have it, is your research going into making up future regulations?
My work specifically now, I don't think it drastically affects regulations. In Texas, I would assume maybe, I'm assuming we might share our data with Fish and Wildlife. I'm sure they're doing studies on all kinds of chemicals and consumer advisories. So I feel like that would take a part in it. Aside from that, mostly what I do currently is I enact the, so I'm not sure if you, this might be just science jargon for you guys. So basically I'm like a frontline person for the EPA. So in 2004, the EPA instilled this Section 316B of the Clean Water Act, where I do impingement and entrainment studies. So it's basically all the water that gets sucked up into something like a power plant or a refinery, any of those industrial sites that needs those cooling water systems. And so for the EPA, so in 2004, they've been doing these studies for many, many years. It's really interesting. You can look, it's easy to find the researchers' data out there. So back in the day, they used to think entrainment, which is when, I think it's more like the fish that aren't supposed to get sucked up that make it into the actual system. Like they just expected an 100% mortality rate for any fish that made it into their entrainment system. Impingement is just the fish that get sucked up right in the surface water that they're collecting to cool their systems down. Now with impingement, those fish that will be on screens. My job is specifically like a lot of refineries, a lot of power plants use fish screens. And the new thing is cooling water towers. It's an open system, so you don't have to maintain and clean and do all these crazy studies on fish because it just keeps it at a good temperature. It doesn't make the fish travel or anything, and it just releases them wherever, from my understanding. But God, I lost my train of thought again. I feel like I'm rambling.
Okay. We're coming up to the next question before we get into the next section. I just had a question for myself. Well, you know, you're pretty much aware of it, that we had that weird bacteria kill of Menhaden up in north, the Raritan, the Back Bay, a lot of that stuff. Did you do any kind of little studies about that?
I've never done studies, but it is definitely noticeable. And I think I've been trying for like a year to see if there's a fish disease class somewhere, whether it's for free or it has like some kind of a fee for it, because I find it really interesting. So the Menhaden I've handled, especially like even my project ended in March, and right towards the end of that project is when I started seeing it. In the colder months, if we do get Menhaden, you don't see it as much, but they'll slowly start coming in. You'll start seeing more and more of those welts and those red worms coming out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. We were at the boat docks and you definitely see them. They seem disembodied. They can't focus. They're swimming around in circles. And you're just like, I don't know. Previous years we get bunker kill offs too. But those were more like lack of oxygen, because like the big bluefish and stuff like that push them into shallow waters. They lose oxygen and then they suffocate. Yeah, we've had that plenty of time. But this is totally something new that we've probably seen in the last just year or two. So I just wondered if you had any idea of like if you did any studies or anything involved with that. That's all.
Yeah, I feel like I actually talked to somebody recently about that, and the lack of oxygen thing is a huge deal with that bunker die off. I also think that the lack of oxygen, or maybe they're pushing them into like dirtier water, might contribute to them being more susceptible to a fungal infection or a parasitic infection. Gotcha. But I do know, do not touch them because apparently it can transfer to people depending on what kind of a fungal infection it is. So even at work, like some of my coworkers don't wear gloves. I wear gloves every single time after I learned that. I was like, I am not handling these fish and waking up with red worm or some fungal infection on my skin like them. I don't want to look like a menhaden.
Swimming around in circles aimlessly.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. I know even 2 years ago when we just started our project, I think it's just one of those things. I haven't really studied it too much, but we actually had a giant influx of striped bass that succumbed to really, really nasty fungal infections. Like they would look fuzzy, like the entire fish. I've seen plenty of dead stripers. Like it happens. They're stressed out. They have their spawn. Lord knows what happens to them, or even natural mortality. But we would get the occasional one that was just long dead. But we had a weird pop for, I think it was April, where we were getting like schoolie sized stripers, like for a chunk of time. And it was almost like every other time we were sampling once a week. And they would just be either completely freshly dead, but covered in this fungus, or like pretty much on their way out. And it was almost like kind of sad to see. I was like, oh, that does not look like a fun way to go. Like they're just very, very sick, like covered from head to toe in these sores.
Has there been any kind of inkling as to what's causing it from your end, or is it still pretty new to your job at this point to figuring out what's going on there?
It's new to me. I'm not really a toxicologist, and we take note of these things, and I'm sure it's something Denrec would like to hear about, or New Jersey or Pennsylvania. Like it's something to take note of, but we're not, since our studies just to see what kind of fish are coming in, what their conditions are. It's not really like to assess and take samples of these fungal infections and to study it. But yeah, it's definitely very new to me. I didn't know that striper got fungal infections that bad.
And one last question before we move on. Previous captains we've talked to from South Jersey, we've talked to them. A couple of them experienced. Have you had any specimens of tarpon up this far?
I've heard of it. Me personally, no, but several of my bosses, coworkers, and even some of the public data I've looked at, just to see what they're getting in other refineries, and even just like for the state, like I've definitely seen, like been reading through papers, and it'll be like tarpon. I'm like, hold on, a tarpon? They're usually not big or anything. They're
juveniles. Yeah. I've seen a juvenile carcass. A couple captains I've talked to have seen them offshore 3 miles. I've had one captain say he's seen one in the marshes rolling on mullet during September. So, I believe these captains, and I mean, the carcass I've seen was definitely 100% tarpon, because I was born and raised in Florida, so I know what a tarpon looks like. So it's kind of like, so it's pretty crazy. But then occasionally we get one of a dead manatee up here too. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, up in the Delaware Bay, we'll get dead manatees washed up on the shorelines.
It's not surprising since, with climate change, that's a whole can of worms. We might even be able to go red fishing soon. but the Gulf Stream isn't that far from us. Like, I even know, I used to volunteer at Camden Aquarium back when there was a moment in time where I was like, maybe I'll just be an aquarist instead of a marine biologist. But they actually collect a lot of their butterfly fish from the Gulf Stream, not too far off the coast of Jersey. So it wouldn't be surprising that, tarpon's just cruising around the Florida coast and gets sucked into that stream. It's just like, all right, I'm just going to follow the food, and ends up here somehow.
No, you're looking for redfish. Just FYI, they're here.
Oh, they are here?
Yeah.
A
captain I know already picked one up. So.
Wow. Is it off the coast of New Jersey?
Back marshes of New Jersey.
Oh.
Yeah.
They're right in Virginia. Figured with the waters getting warmer, like it's crazy seeing this push of fish. Like a lot of my friends and coworkers have been talking about that for a while too. They're like, it's going to be crazy. We're going to probably start seeing some more southern species more and more, even with, with fishing or with work. Like whether you're working like gill netting, electrofishing, working in it, like the, it's going to be crazy seeing that change over time.
I mean, I hope so.
I've,
Go ahead. I was about to say, yeah, I hope so. Because, I mean, back in the day, you know, what was it, 40s, 50s, Dan? We were the redfish capital of the world, right? Corson's Inlet. Yeah, we were the redfish capital. We had bull reds here forever. Because, I mean, I know for a fact last year, a couple of bull reds were caught off the tip of South Jersey. Or within in the like the 40-inch, 45-inch range. Up all the way up the coast, they've been picking off redfish, like good slot flies, 24, 25, 26 inch. They come in with that blue tail because, you know, they be feeding on crabs, crustaceans, and stuff like that. So, yeah, we're going to get an influx of really nice fish in the next few years if this cold ocean water keeps coming in. We're getting some weird pelagics up here, too. So
we've talked about this before, but I've been in October down in Virginia Beach inside the Chesapeake Bay, watching guys net cob mullet and pulling up 18, 19 inch snook in the nets in Virginia. I watched it happen. I saw six or seven of them in one throw. So it's happening. It's quietly happening. A lot of people know more about what's going on than what they're saying, but I mean, there's a legitimate tarpon fishery in the Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
There's a legitimate tarpon fishery behind the Assateague Island. I mean, like 100-pound plus fish back there.
Yeah, not to mention the influx of shrimp in Virginia Beach now. They've moved up enough shrimp, brown shrimp, that there's actually enough stability for a fishery for commercial guys to shrimp in Virginia Beach now. That's pretty far up. I know North Carolina has a good shrimping, South Carolina, but like all the way up to Virginia Beach, there's it's stable enough that it can actually have a commercial shrimping business.
That's crazy. I did some research on that. Sorry. Live on a major road. I did some research on commercial shrimping because of Texas, because that was a part of the whole thing. Like, is it affecting the shrimp? Is it affecting the fish? And I didn't realize like Texas is one of the, I think it might, them and Alaska and maybe Massachusetts are like the top three shrimp guys. Like, you don't even like hear about Virginia. You don't hear about the Carolinas. Like, you know that they shrimp there too. I think they might. Have you guys ever seen like the trawl boats go out of Cape May and stuff? Are they shrimping or are they going for fish?
The trawl boats out of Cape May are usually it's believe it or not, squid. I have a buddy that works on a squid boat that leaves out of Cape May all the time, and they go out for squid.
Oh, that's crazy. Because
probably other stuff too, but like I know that they go out for squid. I know our back marshes in South Jersey, we have shrimp back there because I've been cast netting for bait and I've occasionally picked up 5-6 inch shrimp.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah, I don't think grass shrimp get that big.
No,
right?
No, they're definitely not grass shrimp. I have a photo of it. It's a full blown brown shrimp, like 6 inch brown shrimp.
Wow. Yeah, things are changing, man. It's going to be interesting to see over the next, well, even over our lifetimes, it's going to be very drastic, I think.
Yeah, the only thing we're missing is if we can ever get that back is that eelgrass. If we can get that eelgrass back in like around Corson's and stuff like that, if we get that eelgrass back, the reds will come back. That's the only reason they're gone is because that eelgrass is not there for them.
Do you know what has caused the eelgrass to disappear?
I think it's from storms and sand covering them up, and it just killed them over the years.
So it's natural. It's not from like dredging and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's natural. Yeah. Like I said, we used to be the redfish capital of the world, and that eelgrass right in Corson is what kept them here for so many years. And then as that died off, literally our redfish fishery died off too.
Well, Kate, I know this to be a fact. You're an absolutely killer multi-species fisherwoman. Do you think that, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, but is there something about your job that makes you target specific fish more? Does it make you target specific fish that you find are a little bit in dire shape less? Like, does your job allow you to see the science and allow you to make your decisions of how you target fish?
In a way, I guess. For the most part, I feel like my fishing experience and my science experience are somewhat separate, because they're just so different and you kind of get put in a rock in a hard place. It's hard to be both.
Sure.
Because in one aspect, you're conserving these species, and in another, like, you're also targeting them. And regardless of how well you treat your fish, you're going to cause them a little bit of stress. having a hook in your mouth caught doesn't feel too good.
Right.
But I guess the more sensitive species, like I know striped bass are doing a little bad. Like we just started targeting them this year. And I feel like because I have all this information about that and I'm so worried about their population, I treat them like little babies. Try to get them, you know.
Pet them before you send them back.
In and out, like try to treat them with the utmost care. And I guess like I do have, I'm a little bit more sensitive to fish and It's definitely weird being both.
Like for example, one thing, like, do you ever get frustrated when you read a study that you feel you disagree with, or that the science doesn't back up the study, or what you're experiencing doesn't back it up? Like snakeheads, for example.
I was just going to say that.
We love snakeheads.
That's hard. Yeah. So I guess when you're reading, the biggest problem I have from a science perspective, like when I have to read papers, I want to read the primary source. Not a lot of like everyday people are going to go through a 50 to 100 page boring science paper to decipher, like, you know, the takeout from it. You're not going to spend hours reading that and deciphering the language and they're good about being like, okay, so this is what we're trying to prove. These are the errors that could have happened, but here's like the meat. You want to go to the results. You want to go to the discussion. You want to see the meat of what they found to be true, even though there's always some kind of a swing in that. When you read articles that are like tertiary, or, you know, it was CNN or somebody's blog, they can take, even though they're like, oh, there's been research done, they are taking excerpts from that primary source and twisting the truth around and making it, you know, that grinds any scientist's gears. Snakeheads is probably the worst. Everybody has an opinion about it. I feel like a lot of fishery scientists have kind of become a little bit more lax about it since Maryland has had them established for so long, and they're not finding them to be as decimating as, you know, the fear mongering that's been out in the news. The frankenfish are going to destroy the ecosystem. I haven't read the papers yet. I've looked into some of them, but a lot of bass fishermen hate them because they think they're going to decimate the bass population. And what they found is that, like, when they cut their stomachs open to see what they've been eating, it's very minimal that they're eating bass. But it doesn't mean that they're going to affect the ecosystem in some way or another. They're still eating crawfish. They're still eating minnows. And they're also competition. Sure, so sure. Yep. They're taking it away from other fish too. So that's my rock in a hard place, because I like fishing for them, and it's hard. But you also have to remember, they're not the only invasive species we have in our waters. Right. We have flatheads, we have carp, even technically largemouth bass were introduced, even our beloved rainbow trout. I actually just read a whole book on the great traveling of the trout, like how brown trout came from Germany and rainbows came by train from California. Like, it's just been, sorry, my cats are going crazy. But yeah, it's just crazy to think that, you know, these creatures that people respect and they are sport fishing for them. They're like, oh, trout are amazing. We're going to stock them. We're going to do this. They're invasive too, technically, even though they're introduced.
They are, I guess, considered a welcome introduction to most people, whereas snakeheads were kind of not so welcomed by a lot. But what I have found is that, based off of the things that I've read, and I'm no scientist, but I'm tied in with a lot of people. I've been after snakeheads for many, many years now. And I've tried to, you know, read the science so I have a better understanding. And it seems like they have more effect on closed systems, which is an obvious thing, you know, because obviously they're not, the bait fish are in there. They're not moving out of there. They're not pushing fish out of there. So what are they doing? They're overcompeting for food sources. And then they're eating, they're even in some senses becoming cannibalistic. Down south, for example, the Eastern Shore, there is a legitimate problem there. I mean, they've done studies there where 80% of the biomass on a specific stem of the rivers down there is snakeheads.
Wow.
They're finding more snakeheads in the bellies of snakeheads. So they're just running out of food sources down there. Now, I haven't seen the kind of things up here that I've seen down there. Being I fish all over, I get to take all this different perspectives from a lot of different people. And it's pretty jarring to see what you see down there compared to what we see, because, you know, we have a small snapshot here. We don't have as big of a fishery here compared to what they have down there in Maryland. And that's just exploded down there, and it's snakeheads in a lot of these waters, and there's not a whole lot else. Now, the one thing I have noticed up here is a couple spots where I fish for both snakehead and bowfin, I'm finding that the snakeheads are out competing the bowfin, and I'm catching bowfin that are just, they should be 8-pound fish, and they're 3 or 4-pound fish. They're all head, no body. So it seems like they are a more aggressive predator than the bowfin, just from my take on what I've seen. Compared to 6 years ago, compared to now, caught more bowfin then, not as much now. Now, I'm no scientist. I'm just noticing what I'm seeing different. Now, are you seeing the same things?
Absolutely. Like, that's definitely, like, competition's the number one. Yeah. Like, if they're more aggressive than the bowfin, if they're stronger than the bowfin, they're going to outcompete them every time. You know, there's checks and balances, and we might have a different ecosystem than they do the Eastern Shore too. Cause I know even people talk about how, like, they, you know, mom and dad protect the fry when it comes to a snake head, but you're still going to get bass to take a mouthful of their baby's
hair. Oh, yeah.
But hopefully it doesn't turn into something like that where, it completely just like you said, it's more closed systems. I can't see that really happening in our river, because we have bigger predators than the snakeheads in our rivers. We have muskie and flatheads, and they're like a little noodle to them. But in those closed water systems, or like, I don't know what to call, like the swamps and everything, it's a little nerve wracking because you don't know what's going to happen. In my experience, it's because I'm so new to freshwater fishing, where we fish for snakeheads and bowfins. Every now and then I'll see a really, really nice bass. Like a 3-pound bass, and be like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. But, and you'll see like sunnies and minnows and everything. But I guess, I don't know, when they were introduced a while ago, what was it, early 2000s or something in Philadelphia?
2004 in Meadow Lake. 2004 Meadow Lake, yes. They were introduced. And I don't know. I see, it's hard to say because it's never been confirmed that those fish are what ended up over here on the Jersey side of things, right? So obviously they either moved across the river, they were helped across the river. Mm-hmm. Now, it was also deemed that the strain of snakeheads that were down on the Eastern Shore came from the Jersey strain, same DNA. They share the same DNA. So I'm, like I said, no scientist, but I get off on some of the science of this stuff. I really like to know what I'm talking about. And so obviously all those fish kind of came from up here and down there. I mean, you could literally stand in the same spot and catch 60 fish in an hour and a half without moving. And it's kind of crazy. It's fun, but it's like if you go on a place where you're fishing bluegill beds, you get a bite every time, you get over it, right? So it's one of those things where, you know, there's no balance to the system down there, that they have no pickerel left. Pushed out white perch. There's a whole lot of problems down there.
That's scary. I hope it doesn't happen to us.
Yeah. I'm crossing my fingers, but like I said, they haven't been up here that much shorter of a period of time than they were down there. So I just think it's a completely different system. And the way they're producing down there, that there's just so much untapped water that those fish have plenty of room to hide, plenty of bait fish, and plenty of, waters that people can't even go to. So they're reproducing, and they have a little bit warmer of a climate. So whereas we might get 2 spawns or 3 spawns out of a fish here, they have the potential to get 4 or 5 there under perfect conditions. So it's just the recipe for disaster down there. Whereas I think it's a little bit more in check up here from what I've seen.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the warmer climate definitely has something to do with it.
Oh, for sure.
No snakehead scientist expert, but right. No. It's definitely like, I mean, our waters are completely different from theirs. It could be the quality, it could be the locations. Like you said, it could be the water temperature. Even they can't get as many spawns in. It could be because maybe we have more predatory populations than they do for whatever reason. We might have a little bit more bass or perch. I'm sure perch are aggressive too. They'll eat a little snakehead fry if they get one.
Well, and the bowfin, they don't have the bowfin down there either. So that's another thing that helps keep them in check up here, because I know a lot of the places I fish, some more than others, have bowfin there too, but snakeheads. I've literally caught a bowfin that caught a snakehead on the next cast in the same 2 feet of water. They share water. They're both aggressive. I've had them to where I try to get a picture of this, but I'm working a frog lure, right? And I'm working the stretch of a channel. I'm bringing it through some lily pads to open water. And I have a face off with a snake head and a bowfin. And they're both, the lure's in the middle of the water. And I'm like, oh, I got to get a picture of this. I'm trying to get my hand out of my pocket. My finger's wet, so I can't push the button down. It was when I still had the push button and not to swipe. I'm like, and then I spooked them. And I was like, damn it. That was like the perfect opportunity for the coolest picture. And I blew it.
I literally just had that happen to me the other day.
It's the coolest thing. It's like
you had two of them. It's exciting. I saw these two big V's coming at my frog, and I was like, oh God, who's gonna get it? And they both missed, but the one I caught later, and I'm pretty sure it was the snakehead, but this big, beautiful bowfin. I think it was a male because he had the teal on him still.
Yeah,
like because I don't know. I think they're like curious or they don't mind kayaks too much. He came right up to my kayak after that and just like stared at me, and I was like, okay.
I've fished for bowfin for, I think the first one I caught was 2015, but I've fished for them for a lot, and they're lazy fish. Like you can spook them and they go like 4 inches. Like they don't go anywhere. They just go down as opposed to away.
I feel like they're a little bit more like curious too. I've had bowfin come right up to my kayak staring at me like, what the hell are you doing here? Like, what is this? And then like the lazy thing too, I think I caught like a handful in the spring so far, and all the ones I've caught, that was the most aggressive one I saw. That was last weekend, so things were heating up. But all the ones I caught, I literally would find them and then stick a paddle tail on top of their head and bounce it on their head until they ate it.
Yeah. You've got to get them off enough.
Come to me. Like, I'm just going to sit here and relax. Whereas like the snakeheads at the same time were chasing baits down.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I'm saying. You find that I've found that the snakeheads in the same waters are exponentially more aggressive than the bowfin. Now, if you right place, right time, the bowfin's going to hit your offering, but more times than not, the snakehead is doing the dirty and the bowfin's just kind of hanging, watching.
So, I think they might be faster too, because I haven't caught enough bowfin to really say, but I've never seen bowfin be as acrobatic as snakeheads.
Yeah, for sure. But I will say bowfin put up a much greater fight in my opinion.
Oh yeah. And they also like to run at you, which is weird. Yeah, like that's what I've noticed.
Picking up line like crap. Am I gonna catch up to this thing? So bouncing out to that, I think I probably know one of these, but what are your three favorite fish to target and why?
So my three favorite fish, definitely ever since Texas, I have fallen in love with redfish. The first instance, like my first captain was a guy from Louisiana, and I actually worked on his shrimp. It was like not a shrimp boat. I don't know. I don't know what kind of boat to call it. You know, those big boats they have down south with all the tires that line it.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about? It was one of those. Yeah. It was definitely very interesting. And he's like, you're from Pennsylvania. He's like, have you ever caught a redfish? I'm like, no, I've never, I know what they are, but I've never caught one. He's like, oh, you're going to love this. He's like, I don't know what we have to do, but we're going to make sure you catch one while you're down here. And the way he described their fight, he's like, you've caught a largemouth bass, right? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, imagine that on steroids. And that is a redfish. Like they definitely are tanks. Like I love how much they run. I love their strength. Like it's definitely one of my favorite fish to catch now, especially the one when you start hooking into the bigger ones, it's like, it's insane.
I get made fun of by this guy over here. Cause he's like, Dan's our only non-Jersey fisherman because I go south, I go north, I go all over the place. But listen, I like to, one day I could be targeting salmon, another day I could be targeting redfish, another day I could be targeting flounder, another day I could be targeting lake trout. Yeah. I never know what it's going to be. It's just really, I wake up like, man, today I think I'm going to go catch some flounder. I love it.
And that sounds awesome.
if redfish was readily available to me here in New Jersey and not just these unicorns he's chasing, then I would,
it doesn't count if it doesn't all come
counts,
to Jersey.
All counts. Okay. Boatfish don't count.
That's okay. I've said that for many years until I bought my own. So now,
yeah, of course,
now all boatfish count.
So what are your other two top fish that you like to target, Kate?
I would say if I just want to have a fun day, I love snakeheads and bowfin, dude. Like if they're on, they're on. I don't care how small they are. Like it is a fun day. Just when you get have like a 20, 30 fish day and they're just you could throw a piece of broccoli out there and they're just going to attack it. Like, I think that's more of like, we pick those days to go out when, you know, if we went fishing for like lake trout the day before and got skunked, I'm like, all right, let's go for snakeheads tomorrow. It's warm. It's cloudy. We know they're going to be on. Like, that's always a really fun day. I feel like there's not as much disappointment with those fish.
Sure.
They're a fun fight. For the harder ones though, I would say anything in the Esox species. I think they're definitely hands down my favorite fish, but just the way they look, the way they act, they're so mysterious. And like I said before, I think pike, I would love to feel what a 40 to 50 inch pike fight feels like.
Me too. I tried. I found them this big in a little puddle.
Yeah. The ones we usually catch, we usually just explore the entirety of the Passaic River. They're just everywhere.
There's some big ones up there. They're in there. They're just in little pockets. You'll never find them.
Yep, they're little unicorns. You'll catch a bunch of the smaller ones, like 15 to 25 inches usually were. But even those little guys, your rod just bends right in half. Like they are fighters, and they fight. I think pike fight so much harder than muskie. Like they just don't give up. And even when you get them in the boat and they're tired, you think they're done. They're not, and they're full of teeth. It's a little stressful sometimes.
Those are definitely on my bucket list in the next few years. Ginormous northern pike and a muskie on a fly. But I'm going up to Canada for that.
That's where all the big pike are, I think, too.
But we're gonna turn it back just for a second about the snakeheads. I always debate with Dan about this, and I want your honest answer. Top water or subsurface? Which one do you like?
I know what she's gonna say.
All right. Well, when I worry about you, worry about her answer.
That's okay.
I think for fun, top water. I think if it's not going so hot, especially in the early season, I don't even bother with top water. I think subsurface is the way to go. I think that, especially if you're in a more pressured area, I think they see frogs all damn day long. And when you throw something a little different, you throw a paddle tail out there, they absolutely crush it. And people are sitting there pissed off that you're catching them left and right. They're sitting there still throwing a frog when the water is like 50 degrees. I think I've had more luck on paddle tails than I have on, and I think the hookup ratio is better too.
Not only that, they fight better subsurface too. They don't give up. Whereas you're skiing them across all that muck on the top. It's like a wet towel. Like unless it's a big fish, but subsurface, they don't give up. They dive, they dive, they dive. I will take it to my grave. I prefer to catch them subsurface. When it switches to top water, I switch to salt water.
Oh yeah.
I'll take top water.
I'll revisit it every once in a while because it's fun, but
I just like the explosions. That's just what I do. Top water, anything. Anything I can catch on top water, it's happening.
Even on the paddle tails, I've had them launch out of the water grabbing those paddle tails. If they're really sluggish, I'll kind of keep them towards the bottom. If they're a little bit more on, I'll keep them closer to the surface, because sometimes even kind of skirting it on the surface and letting that paddle make a little bit of noise that'll fire them up.
maybe I just haven't gotten into that subsurface bite. I won't know, because I've only been targeting for a year, so I've only been spoiled by the top water bite. So
yeah, so summer is where the top water bite's at, I think. I think we throw a little more top water when it's hot out. I think it's
super hot.
Riled up. And I also like the weird thing with snakeheads. I think if you make a lot of noise, well, like if you're using it, sometimes even if you're using a spinner, just to create some noise, I think it draws them in. That's something else I noticed. That's really weird. I think if you stay in one area for long enough and you create enough ruckus, I think it does. They're like, oh, what's that over there? And eventually you get a couple that come in and check it out. And that's definitely like a weird thing I've noticed with them compared to any other fish. I think that they are attracted to certain noises.
I prefer to fish. My buddy Trung, who has SS Custom Baits, and he has these Cobra spinner baits that just thump like no other. And when I tell you these fish school, you and I fish a very specific place a lot. These fish, I found them schooling in that area where I'll have 7, 8 of them chase it in. I've never seen it anyplace else. I've seen pictures of a bunch of them congregated in one area, but that one place where we fish, I'll cast it out in the channel, bring it back slow, and I'll see 6-7 of them just taking a swipe out of it. One misses, it's in the other one's mouth before you know it. And that to me is where it's at. That's fun.
Oh, it's wild. And yeah, it is crazy how most of the time I think they're pretty solitary, but I know what you're talking about. Like even when it's a clear day, you can see through the water. I've seen multiples in the same area.
It's not just a pair. Like there's 6 or 7 of them that'll follow the bait in. It's not like they're paired up and it's this or that. Like there's 2 spots that I fish that are like this. Similar setup. There's a channel with edges that are completely grown in. And then you get them where they'll come out, I guess, out of the lily pads and follow it all the way up. And it's like, it blows your mind because you'll see, and not even just one size class, like you'll see an 8-pounder next to a 2-pounder. And it's just, I've never seen it anyplace else. I've tried to get video of it. It's just not clean enough. You know, that spot, it's not clean enough there to get it.
No, it's hard.
Quality video of it.
Have you noticed, cause I didn't see a lot of fry balls this year. I feel like we started fishing for something else and I kind of missed that part of the summer last year. Do you notice that when they do have their fry, do they kind of separate because they're so focused on protecting their young or anything? Or do you think they're still kind of in like clumped together, but they just have their babies with them?
Yeah. Like, so when there's fry balls, I don't notice that schooling happening at that point. Not at all. No.
I feel like that's when they get really aggressive.
And that's still, we're still in the midst of that. So there's pairs in some places. I've seen 2 or 3 fry balls already. That hasn't blown up yet.
No, I hate when they all decide to spawn at once and then they don't want to bite.
I usually once I see fry balls, that's when I move on. Cause I don't fish for them when they're on fry. I know a lot of people do. I catch plenty. I don't want to make it even easier. I mean, they're already a pretty easy fish to catch if you know what you've been doing. And I kind of bridge this little gap where I'm into conservation and I know they're a problem, but I don't want to mess with them when they're doing their thing with their babies. I know it's bad. There's going to be people listening and it'll be like, what is he saying? But listen, I've been fishing for these fish for like 9 years. So I kind of love them a little bit, but you know, I also hate them because they take up so much of my spring. And then I'm like, God, what did I do all spring?
Yeah. We had to take a break and we went hardcore for muskie. Once we kind of figured when their spawn was over, it was game time. I think Mike got, what did you get, 2? Yeah, he got 2 and I got the 1 biggins. I'm happy with that.
You guys fish 10 minutes from me. I live close to one of those places, by the way.
Oh, nice. Yeah, there's it's like they're not secret spots, but
no need to add pressure to places we fish, though.
No, because especially with muskie, that is a big hot topic. I know snakeheads are so controversial just because they're invasive and I also don't agree with, I don't even know if I should say this, like how John Hines like tries to force you to kill them. I don't think that they should put that management pressure on any person. Like you don't know what kind of religious beliefs they have regardless. Like if you're going to maintain a fishery, the amount of fishermen that can kill a snakehead is not even going to put a dent in when you can bring, if you really want to maintain that or you want to manage it, go bring a gill net in, go bring an electrofisher in, figure it out. Like, don't make the poor recreational fishermen sit there. And we used to kill them back when we first started, because I felt bad. And I was a fishery scientist. I'm like, oh, I really shouldn't be letting these fish go. And until you realize how hard it is to actually kill them.
Yeah.
And it's not humane. We didn't enjoy it at all. Like, it's just, they're so thick, like their meat and their heads and their skulls are just so thick. I don't think there's a very, unless you take a machete to their head, like, I really don't think there's a very humane way of killing them.
Not only that, like, they expect you to kill them and then they'll tell you, I have video of the guys there that work there say, just toss them in the woods. Like, this is a bird watching community and you're going to toss carcasses of fish in the woods if you're not going to keep them. And then
you want them to complain more, the smell.
Then the flip side of this is if you're eating those fish out of those waters, you're doing something wrong. Like, I mean, I've seen people that have filleted a snakehead from John Hines and the flesh is more, has a brown tinge to it compared to other. It's just not smart.
I
think you need to do something there. if they and listen, they have half of the more than half of the place shut off to fishing. Like you want these recreational guys to come in here and help you with your problem, yet you're not allowing access to most of the places where they can catch them.
No, and if they're going to enforce it and ticket people too, I think that, you know, I get it. I get they're invasive. I get like you're trying to protect your wetland, your birds, but like at the very bare minimum, maybe have a disposal, like a bin or something to put them in, like
something.
And plus, I know snakeheads aren't light. Like if you catch like 6 snakeheads in a day, imagine having to lug that around that park all day. I mean, they're all going to be alive still. And that's the other thing people don't realize, they breathe air. Like they can't live forever out of the water, but that's the thing too. So you throw them in the woods, like if it's strong enough and healthy enough, it'll make its way right back. my boss actually misidentified. He's like, oh, I got a snakehead here. And I'm like, send me a picture right now. And it was a bowfin. And I was like, that's not a snake, it's a bowfin, Ryan. But he's like, well, it's been in the bucket for like 5 hours. It's probably dead. I'm like, it's not dead. I'll be there soon. I'll deal with it. And he's like, no, it's got to be dead. And I picked this thing up and he's like, oh my God. He's like, you're just going to pick it up like that? I'm like, yeah, it's alive. Look.
I've had buddies who have fished down on the Eastern Shore, which is about 3 hours away from here, cut the gills on a snakeheads, put them under ice, get home to clean them. Hours later, and they're still alive. That there's not a more resilient fish out there than snakeheads. So it's just like you said, it's not humane what they're asking you to do in there. I haven't fished in there in over 2 years just because I don't agree with what they're doing there. I know there's great fish in there. I used to catch some massive fish in there. I just refuse to do it. Yeah. I just can't. I mean, there was one time the lady had her binoculars on me from the woods and she gave me a warning. I'm out of here. So done with that.
Yeah, all right. I feel like a lot of fishermen don't fish there anymore because of that. Like they don't feel comfortable. They don't feel like they can just relax and enjoy their day. And that's not right. And that's not going to help your cause at all. Like
they've actually done the opposite. They've done the exact opposite.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So going back to snakeheads, what is your PB snakehead?
Oh crap. How big was that one last year? The other one. There's 8.7 and then there was remember the secret place?
Yeah. I bet you I know it.
Secret place. Probably the 9 pound range. I forget it's on, I think his Instagram or my Instagram, the weight, but
very nice.
Yeah. The thing was a tank. He was very butthurt. Yeah. We can't get to the double digits, man. We've only been fishing for him for what? 2-3 years, maybe that, but we've tried so many, but I've seen them. We've yet to catch a double digit.
I think I'm on year 9 and I think I only have like 6 double digits. So,
yeah, I don't know. Like I wanted to like actually research in they're like how big they get in their natural, like where they come from. I guess it's like Thailand or I know they're a northern snakehead. So I'm assuming they're like in the more northern range of that.
Russia, China. And there's another place that they're from, but yeah. They max out here in the U.S. further than they do in their natural habitat.
Wow. I did not know that. That's crazy.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's the some of the records from down Virginia, Maryland area are fish that are pushing 40 inches and they're documented to tap out around 32, 33 inches in like Russian area and all that. So.
Well, you just said 40 inches. Holy crap.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere. I think the biggest one in Eastern Shore was somewhere around like 23-24 pounds.
Yeah, they've gotten 23-24 pounders and fike nets down there.
Yeah, I know Kaz got some really big ones in the nets.
Yeah.
My God.
So if you want your chance at a double digit, you let me know and I'll send you on your way. I have all the spots.
Yeah, right. I broke one off last year and I almost cried. So
yeah.
Send us.
I was there for it. We'll trade big snakehead spots for northern pike spots.
Oh, that's easy.
Mike and I've already worked this out. We've already talked about it. So we just gotta put it into motion.
Everybody's gotta find the big ones though. That's the only problem. You can catch pike all damn. It's still fun. Like those 20 some inch pike, it's what? It's the bait you gotta throw. Oh. Sorry, Mike's chiming in. He's like, it's the baits. We got to switch up the baits we're throwing.
All right. So what are your bucket list fish that you have left to settle up with? I mean, obviously you get all over the place. What other fish do you have out there that you haven't targeted yet that are going to happen at some point?
I made a list because it's so hard to like pinpoint what I want, because I want to catch every fish that's in this world. We've already had quite a few. Oh, so one of the big ones that I keep seeing more and more, and I really, really would love to travel to British Columbia for, is white sturgeon.
Wow. That's a first. We have not heard that one yet.
Yeah.
I know there was an article, I think it was last year, the year before, I forget. It was Father's Day. Probably the best Father's Day for this father and son ever. And I forget. I think it was either 600 or 900 pounds. I mean, that's a huge difference, but that's how big that white sturgeon was. Wow. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure they're white sturgeon because they have lake sturgeon, green sturgeon in that area too. But they just look like they fight. Like they're acrobatic. They're just such weird dinosaur looking fish. Like I worked with Atlantic sturgeon and short nosed sturgeon. And yeah, I just have such a respect for them because they literally look like living dinosaurs.
Yeah, we've caught an Atlantic sturgeon about 3 years ago off the surf. It was, wow. And then I think our buddy, he put it on Instagram, and then the Department of Fishery reached out to him right away and told him to take the photo down. And they called him. They're like, all right, we need to know where you caught it, what you caught it on, and approximately how long was it. And did you release it? And they're like, it was like instantly within a few minutes, they reached out right away. And
they don't mess around. They do not mess around.
They don't.
I even working with them, like my boss made it a point whenever, because we gill net the juveniles and we tag them. But every time we would get one, he's like, get it, get it, get it. It was like a mad dash. Cause he's like, if we were to even accidentally kill one of them, they would pull our permit for research. Like they do not mess around with them because they're so endangered. And there's a guy, I got to get his last name. You would love to talk to him. His name's Hal. I just call him Hal the Surgeon Guy. He's been working on the Delaware River for eternity. Like he's probably in his 70s and he's still on his John boat doing research out there. And they only believe that there's like 100 breeding adults that go in and out of the river every single year. And that's it. Wow. I mean, I think they're coming back, but it's weird because like, my boss would say, he's like, there's years where we get none, no juveniles. He's like, and then the year I was there, we got like 200 in the fall. And he's like, I don't understand. He's like, I don't know why. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not, depending on their spawn or how the year went. Like they're extremely protected. And that's good that they're catching them in the surf. Maybe hopefully they're coming back and hopefully they're making more little sturgeon in our river.
I know that they've had a successful program down on the James River in Virginia, and they've seen a comeback down there. So hopefully we can see some of that success up this way as well.
Oh yeah. Cause we didn't get to study adult. I mean, the Delaware River is so big. It's like impossible to try to get those breeding adults, and there's so few, you don't really want to mess with them. I think we did the Nanticoke River, and the entirety of that project, I was actually away in Greece for almost like a month, and I thought I was going to miss the whole project. I was very, very lucky. I got to see one adult in the 3 or 4 months. I think they did the project. They only technically caught two adults in that river the whole time. Cause they caught the one twice by accident.
Oh, jeez. Catch and release works.
Yep.
I've been fishing for stripers at Conowingo, and we've seen them go airborne there. Probably 20 yards out. Like you'll see them just go way out of the water. And they're not, I mean, that water, I mean, I don't know if you know much about Conowingo. It's pretty shallow. Like it's not super deep there below the gates and below the.
You would think it would be deeper there because there's gushing water. And it's just like, you would think from the velocity and the pressure, it would kind of like bore it a little bit deeper.
It's just amazing the size of fish that are down there. I mean, this probably was 5-6 feet, not a huge one, but it was an adult sized fish, and it was cool to see. I'll never forget that. It was probably 10
11 years Delaware. Ago. You see him in the Delaware a lot. And the most I've seen, we were actually at Camden Aquarium the one day, and we were just outside like having a cigarette and we had my nephew and my family with me, and Mike's looking out at the water right there, and one jumped right in front of us. And he's like, what was that? I'm like, that was sturgeon. He's like, nah. I'm like, mm-hmm. And then up closer to the Navy Yard and where all the barges are, you don't really see a lot of recreational traffic up there, but we would go up there just to see if we could find juveniles or mark them and stuff. And the first time I ever saw one was all the way up there. And I was like, I asked my boss, I'm like, Ian, what was that? And he's like, a sturgeon. I'm like, why did that 5-foot fish just jump out of the water like that? Do they do that a lot? He's like, yep, nobody knows why. I'm a sturgeon biologist. We have no idea why they do that.
Yeah, I know a lot of my buddies will be out surf fishing or be out on the boat striper fishing and see them going airborne out there too. So now I'm going to start wrapping up my questions here, but I got a good one for you. Now I've fished next to you and Mike when we were walleye fishing, but you guys fish together all the time. How often does it get competitive between the two of you? And what fish has he caught that really gets you jealous and vice versa? Like, is there something that he has down that you don't and something that you do better than he does? He's laughing.
Yes, definitely. So we kind of each have our own knack for certain species and it's definitely noticeable. I think, you know, cause there's always, you always get a little tiny, tiny butt hurt when, you know, your significant other is catching a bigger fish than you, or they're like having all the luck that day and you're sitting there casting your arms off and you're like, why can't I just hook into one fish today? And you're sitting here like you're on like your 10th fish.
Yeah.
I think the one I'm the most jealous about with him is muskie. I have taken so many of his muskie pictures and like I'm there right next to him fishing, casting all day, every day until my arms fall off. And I'm like, what am I doing wrong? I don't understand. Like he's had 2 or 3 muskie days and I'm sitting there like, I'm not even taking your pictures anymore. I'm done.
Set up the time yourself, Mike.
Right? Like,
and how about him? Is there something that you do a little better than he does that he gets a little jealous of?
Oh yeah. So last year, I think I got the snakeheads and bowfin on him. Like there's days where he'll see the same thing. Okay, he gets all butthurt, he gets all upset, and he'll like scuttle away on his kayak because he's just like, oh my god, he's like, what are you doing? He's like, what are you using? He'll even be like, give me that frog or give me like what color paddle tail. Like he's like, I don't care what's on your line. He's like, cut your line and give it to me. Cause I'm so mad right now.
Like, you got the right kind of wiggle. He doesn't have the wiggle.
The finesse, that, and then we started going for lake trout last year. For the first time, like we've never been deep water jigging.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
guess maybe it's a female's touch with that. I don't know. Cause it's just, you kind of got to finesse and like, it's a totally different type of fishing. Like yeah. it's just being like 80 feet in the water and just lightly finessing these little jigs or paddle tails or whatever you have down there. Like I had a day where we were just trying to use all kinds of different lures. We found, and he still gets mad about this, he bought this little tiny ice fishing lure. It's like yay big and like just silver and blue, kind of looked like a little tiny like herring or shad. But it was really tiny and really heavy, so it goes down real fast. And he's like, because they were using bigger spoons and everything, I'm like, let me try this little tiny guy. And I absolutely slayed that day. I broke my PB smallie twice. I got the biggest lake trout of the day. I got a rainbow trout. I don't know if I got the salmon that day too, but he was... Okay, I got the salmon that day too. I crushed it.
Elephants eat peanuts. Elephants eat peanuts. My only muskie came on a 1-inch lure like that.
It's amazing how that works.
And I was fishing for yellow perch and crappie, and I had just read an article in Fisherman that said that these little tiny jigging wrap type lures work well in open water after ice out. So. Obviously this was a little bit way past ice out, but I tie on this little, it was a Northland tackle puppet minnow, hook on the front, hook on the back, like a typical jigging wrap lure. And, I drop it down and I see like these bluegills boiling on the top of the water. So I'm like, yeah, let me investigate. I'm fishing 6-pound test, a little 50 size reel, a little crappy rod, like a crappy fishing rod, like an actual crappy, the fish. And lo and behold, the first time I drop it down, I hook up and I'm like, God, what did I do? Did I snag a carp or something? Next thing I know,
yep.
6-pound test. I'm having to finesse this fish all over the lake. My father-in-law's right next to me. It's a week after my son was born. And he tied his kayak to my kayak because we were trying to slow this fish down. There was no way. Like, I fought this. I was finessing this fish for over 25 minutes.
Oh my God.
Because like every time I would get it up close to me, it would just take another run. It was 45 inch muskie. It was about 30 pounds, I think. And
oh my God. Yeah. That's a lot of muskie for that.
On a lure that epic. I'm fishing for panfish. I have no net. My father-in-law hands me like a trout net. I'm like, what the hell am I going to do with this? So I get it up next to me like seven times. And finally, the last time I'm able to get it in the boat. And if you scroll way down to the beginning of my Instagram, you'll see that fish. But oh my God, it was nuts. Like 6 pounds.
It was tired, so it didn't thrash around in your kayak.
No. And that's what he said. He's like, dude, you got the head of that thing right in your groin area. You better maneuver that thing around. Like, I don't have any place to put this thing right now. I wasn't prepared for this.
And like,
I was shaking for probably a day and a half after that. It was such a rush.
Oh, absolutely.
I've never caught one on purpose. I've only gotten that one like that. And I don't target them a lot, but I plan to now. So
I swear to God, you get more follows when you're not targeting them or hook into them. Like, I hear a lot of guys that bass fish, catch them on frogs and stuff all the time. And I'm like, what?
that would be pretty cool to get them on top water.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Mike's only gotten one on top water. I think his first one ever out of the Stuckel River.
Whopper plopper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. They're a crazy fight.
Yeah, I'm gonna up my game a little bit on the Esox species because I've always been fascinated, but now I'm trying to like do some things I haven't done. Build up my book a little bit.
Oh yeah, it's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. Yeah, for sure. Fishing for muskie, more so tears.
I gotta drag my boat out of saltwater and take it up to the special lake. Now I gotta go hunt for them up there.
Well, there's a lot of days where you won't move fish. The worst, I think, is when you have days where you move the fish and you don't hook into any. You get so excited. You get like what they call like buck fever when you're hunting. It's like that with muskie. I keep calling it the muskie fever because every time I get a follow, I just start shaking. So I'm like, oh my God, is it about to happen? And they're like, no. Like, they'll follow it right to the boat. They'll open their mouth at it. They'll bump it. I almost hooked into one on a, like you said, elephant sea peanuts. I had a 30 some inch muskie tried to eat a trout spinner not too long ago. And I was like, oh God, oh God. I'm like, I can't bite it, but maybe not. Cause I don't know how I'm going to deal with this.
Right. It's like, there's often times where I'm like, I have no business doing what I'm doing right now. If I catch anything, I'm going to be so screwed.
Exactly. So many moments like that.
I'm like, holy crap. What am I doing? I'm throwing like my trout rod at this muskie I saw pass me, and it's dumb, but hey, if I can make it work, it's worth a try.
Tests all the time. I'm like, yeah, maybe it is possible. Maybe we can make this happen somehow.
Yeah.
And we even actually tonight, so apparently right now the flatheads are crushing artificial baits. Never targeted them like that before. I just went down behind our house to go because we have a little smallies. You never know back there. I caught two muskie back there. It's the river. You never know. There's been plenty of days where I go down there just to drink a beer and chill and like catch absolutely nothing, but I'm outside and I'm just relaxing. Two days ago, we landed five flatheads, a walleye, and the biggest smallmouth I've ever seen in the Schuylkill River. Like, it was a maybe two and a half, 3 pound fish. I didn't weigh it, but that got me excited because I'm like, all the smallies I catch in that river, they're so small. Like I've never, ever seen them get past like that 2 pound mark. Really.
They're really hard to find on the Schuylkill as a whole anymore. Anyway.
Yeah. Everybody complains about it. It's definitely, that's a big deal. The flatheads though, the one I caught, well, how about 38 pounds? We got a 38 and a 40 on, no, it's not, I think it's 14 on my salmon rod that has 14 pound fluoro on it. I've landed on it and I'm just like sitting here like, I shouldn't be throwing this, but I'm going anyway. And you know, we've landed everyone, not a single one has broken off. So it's like magical line or something like that.
There you go. Well, Kate, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Quad, do you got anything for Kate? Anything? I think we've covered like everything we possibly can.
Yeah, we definitely did. I don't have any other questions. We covered everything.
Kate, it's been great talking to you. You are you're amazing. We love all the conversation we've had with you today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Is there any social media plugs you want to share, how people can get in touch with you if they want to?
Not really. I have my Instagram, the pepperseed88. I'm just one of those people. I'm always so busy with my science work and fishing that like social media kind of takes the back burner sometimes. Like I have so many photos in my phone right now that just haven't even like touched my Instagram. I have photos from last year that I'm like, oh my God, can I even post these anymore? Like, is that allowed? Is that a thing?
nobody knows. Nobody knows but you.
Right. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
Well, guys, you can find Kate at pepperseed88 on Instagram.
Oh, and Mike at Tightlines Philly, of course.
And Mike, her boyfriend, at Tightlines Philly. They're two incredible fishermen. Go check out their Instagrams. They have like the Rolodex of fishing photos. It's sickening if you are a multi-species fisherman, because you can go there and salivate for a little bit. But it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Mike, you guys are great. We'll have you on soon. And thank you very much. We're going to stay on for a little bit, but it was a pleasure to chat with you, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, anytime. Thank you guys for having me.
Of course.
No problem.
All right, Kate. Thank you.
All right, guys. Well, you have a lovely night. We'll talk soon.
All right.
Have a good night.
All right. Bye.
A lot of content there, man. They're all over the place.
We went everywhere with it.
Yeah, man. That's gonna be one for the books there, I think.
That's gonna be one for those road trips to the shore, guys. I'm gonna need about an hour and a half time for this one.
It might be our longest recording yet, but it was a lot of good content there. Kate is absolutely filled with knowledge. So is her boyfriend, Mike. I definitely recommend checking them out. At pepperseed88 on Instagram and at Tightlines Philly on Instagram. They're two great people. They're very kind. They'll help you out. Don't hesitate to reach out to them. And Kate's doing some big things in the fishery world. So she is a wealth of knowledge. And I appreciate having people like that on my side. So
most definitely. Like I said, not too many people, you don't know too many people that are marine biologists. You know, growing up, that was one of my, as a kid growing up, that was kind of one of my dream jobs. You know what I mean? Like living in Florida, going to SeaWorld all the time. You know what I mean? Like it's one of those jobs that as a kid you always wanted to be at. I guess that's where leads me to where I'm at today as a fisherman, being a conservationist and stuff, just trying to protect the species, you know. And when you get the science side of it with, you know, with Kate and stuff like that, you know, we kind of get the gist of it. You know what I mean? Sometimes it's fun and games. Other days it's just hard work. And I mean, they do the best at their job to just try to help our fishery as much as possible.
Absolutely. Well, everybody, thanks again for tuning in. You can find us at Tide_Chasers on Instagram, Tide Chasers Podcast on Facebook. You can find my man Qua over here at That Asian Angler on Instagram. And then I am at DMancari18 on Instagram. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for tuning in as usual. Please like, subscribe, share the content, leave us some feedback, and tight lines, everybody. Thank you for tuning in.
Yeah. Good night, everyone. Keep those lines tight, and we'll see you guys on the next episode.